Good morning, all. Just one moment. For our first case for argument this morning is Russian Media Group versus Cable America. So, Mr. Korninsky.
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. USA Satellite and the other defendants request that the preliminary injunction be reversed for four reasons. First, it's overbroad and prohibits the distribution of any and all Russian programming, not just the distribution of Russian programming under the single-user accounts that the district court found to be improper. Second, it's based upon a violation of the Illinois Cable Piracy Act, which is preempted by the Copyright Act. It's also negated by the doctrine of res judicata. And finally, the district court abused its discretion when it found that RMG was an aggrieved party under the Illinois Cable Piracy Act.
I'd like to just start you off, if I might, by asking you if you believe that the illegal actions of the defendants could have been prevented under the terms of the state court settlement, and as well as part of enforcement of the terms of that settlement, could you have presented to the state court the evidence of the continuing violations and possibly have obtained redress there?
Your Honor, the issue, this dispute could have been resolved by the state court. In the state court action, Russian media, RMG, accused Cable America of distributing unauthorized Russian programming under these single-user accounts. If you refer to the complaint, which is at the supplemental record C, Exhibit 1, the identical operative facts were at issue in the state court action.
So
RMG dismissed those claims with prejudice in return for a license under the 2001 settlement agreement so that he could enter Cable America's properties and compete against Cable America there. The state court judge retained jurisdiction to resolve all disputes under this 2001 settlement agreement between RMG and Cable America.
So just let me try and understand this. The case is not limited to conduct all right, let me put it this way. Is it a combination of conduct that was a part of the state court action and other conduct that could not have been raised at that time because it occurred later? Or could it all have been raised?
It was all raised at the state court action, Your Honor. There were several issues in the state court action. The issue here is whether Cable America was distributing Russian programming without authorization under these single-user accounts. And I'd like to refer the court to the complaint in paragraphs 51 through 55 and 105 through 114. I'm just going to read two sections.
But my understanding was that some of the behavior occurred later, after the state court action.
Yes, Your Honor. Cable America was distributing Russian programming under these single-user accounts before the 2001 action and after.
So then how could it all have been taken care of?
Because the RMG wanted the state court to resolve this issue about whether Cable America was permitted to offer these Russian programming under these single-user accounts from these different content providers. They dismissed that allegation with prejudice in return for this license agreement that they got. Now, the identical Russian programming from the same content provider, Dish Network, was offered 2000 all the way into 2005. RMG's argument here is that because they only litigated a subset in the state court action, that res judicata doesn't apply.
Mr. Korninsky, excuse me. if I steal your car in 2001 and we reach a settlement about that, and then I steal your car again in 2008, does that prior settlement and judgment amount to res judicata?
Under those facts, circumstances, no. What happened here is that the parties came to an agreement that this conduct, this distribution of Russian programming under the single user accounts was permissible. They dismissed those counts, and in return for dismissing it, they got a license that they could enter Cable America's properties. They accepted it. Judge McGann dealt with these issues on numerous occasions in the state court action because he retained jurisdiction to resolve any disputes over the settlement agreement. Now, this court has addressed this type of issue in the Fryer versus City of Vandalia case. They addressed this argument that only a subset of the properties were litigated makes, and this, let me start again and say it this way. In Fryer versus City of Vandalia, this court held that a defendant, us, may raise a res judicata when the plaintiff litigated a subset of the properties in the first action. In Fryer, using your car analogy, the plaintiff litigated over four cars in the federal action, two of which were identical to the state court action. Here, RMG is litigating over 20 properties. 17 of those properties are identical in the state court action.
But can you identify any case in which we have applied res judicata to what is essentially recidivist conduct rather than to the same conduct that formed the basis of the prior action?
Your Honor, I guess I think that it is the identical conduct. Under the test for res judicata, you have to see if the operative facts are the same or nearly the same. And here, it's the same parties, it's the same activities, this distribution of the Russian programming under the same account, the single user accounts, for the same properties, from the same content provider. Well, the content provider, they addressed all content providers in the state court action, including Dish Network. Dish Network is the same here, and in 2005, we added DirecTV. But that still goes to the same subset argument that this court addressed in the Fryer case.
Mr. Korniski, let me ask you about your first point about the scope of the injunction. As I understand it, we've got several premises here. Tell me if you dispute these. One is that your client committed fraud on DirecTV by lying about the intended uses of the single-user accounts. Is that correct?
No.
What's wrong about that?
Our client was using the single-user accounts and distributing these. They bought the receivers.
They were telling DirecTV these are single-user accounts, and then they were redistributing for sale, correct?
They weren't distributing. They were distributing programming. They didn't resell
Distributing programming,
yes,
for further sale, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so they're lying to DirecTV about the intended use of the programs, correct?
No, Your Honor.
We'll go past that. Second, your clients were then using the stolen programming to compete unfairly against the plaintiff by, in essence, being able to sell stolen programming at a low cost, right?
No, Your Honor. Under the single user accounts, they paid for the programming, and then they distributed to the other subscribers in the building, and they charged for the services that were our Cable America's business models. They go into a building and they install satellite cables and cable wires. They offer English programming. They offer
and they purchase the programming by saying it's for single use, correct?
Yes.
But then they go on to distribute reselling that programming to many other participants, right? To your customers.
No, if they don't sell the programming, what they do is that the people paying rent for use of the satellite wiring, they're paying the monthly fee is for when they go and they service the properties, when people have problems, you know, and the wiring is not working or the TV's not
obviously
working.
Obviously, the district court didn't view things that way, did it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And then it's also clear, I understand you haven't gone with my first two points, but would you agree that your clients violated the terms of the injunction?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. We're agreed that
it's,
far.
It's,
and
it's
and this issue
now,
about the scope of the injunction is still before the district court, correct?
No, Your Honor. We asked the court to clarify the scope of the order, and it declined. As I said, that jurisdiction, the issue had it was, they didn't have jurisdiction. That the issue was before this court.
When did that happen?
A few days before we filed our reply brief, which is, it's November 10th, docket 325.
Thank you.
Okay, now going back to the overbroad injunction issue, the court is required to scope or to tailor the scope of the injunction so that it prohibits the illicit activities. Here the court found that the improper activities was the use of these single-user accounts. Yet the scope of the injunction prohibits any Russian programming under any agreements. The court had before it the two MDU agreements. It also had, after the injunction, some SMAD-V contracts, which show that there are other ways to distribute Russian programming that are not covered under the single-user accounts. The court has declined to review that because it says that this issue is before this court. But because the scope of the injunction prohibits any Russian programming, not just the improper conduct, it's overbroad, and under the Lamb-Weston case, it should be reversed. Now, competitors all over the country are able to distribute Russian programming using the MDU agreements and SMAD-V agreements that the court has not so far considered. USA Satellite is using these MDU agreements and SMAD-V agreements to offer other programming at over 100 properties. But because of the overbroad scope of the injunction, it can't use any of those agreements to offer the Russian programming at the 20 enjoined properties. In fact, there's one competitor in some of the enjoined properties who's offering Russian programming using these SMAD-V contracts. They can do it, but because of the scope of the injunction, Cable America and USA Satellite are not permitted to do so. Now, I'd like to turn to my second point, which is the preliminary injunction should be reversed because RMD's allegations about the unauthorized distribution of Russian programming under the ICPA is preempted by the Copyright Act. Now, the court's Baltimore Orioles case sets forth a two-part test to determine whether or if the ICPA is preempted by the Federal Copyright Act. Under the first prong, the Russian programming at issue here is fixed in tangible form and is covered by the Copyright Act. The controlling Seventh Circuit case is WGN Continental Broadcast, which found that television programming transmitted by cable companies is within the Copyright Act. RMG's briefs are totally silent. They never address that case.
Are we talking about of the orders that were appealed to us, the emergency motion to modify the preliminary injunction? Is
yes.
that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Well, that's the only one in which preemption was even an issue.
Correct.
And that motion was denied as untimely. It was denied as not having properly been raised as an emergency. It was denied as seeking relief that was outside the district court's jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And as far as I can tell in the briefs, but you tell me if I'm wrong, you have failed to assert that any of those reasons for denial were erroneous. So how can we find that the preemption issue is properly before us?
Because, Your Honor, in the district court's denial of the motion, they said they didn't have jurisdiction over the preemption issue because it was before this court. It said that this court had jurisdiction to decide the preemption because this case has been appealed. Now,
so is it your position then that the district court decided that the issue has not been forfeited for purposes of this appeal? That would be kind of odd.
I don't understand, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
I don't understand your position.
the district court said that they didn't have jurisdiction to address the preemption issue because mm-hmm. the whole preliminary injunction has been appealed, and that.
So, but presumably the We know that the issue was not raised until the preliminary injunction was entered and appealed, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Do you agree with the point that the appellees made that the district court did not reach the plaintiff's claims under some other statutes because the Cable Piracy Act statute or a claim was sufficient to grant the injunctive relief?
Yes.
So, and to consider whether there was any prejudice as a result of the failure to raise the copyright preemption issue before the district court, we'd also have to think about how the district court might have ruled on those other issues if your clients had raised the preemption issue before the district court?
Your Honor, we did raise the preemption issue.
Until after the injunction was issued.
But okay. USA Satellite wasn't even allowed to intervene until May 17th. We raised the preemption issue three times. On May 26th, in a motion to stay, in our answer in July, in June, and then a motion to modify the injunction in July. So it was raised, and as I understand RMB's argument, they're arguing that they were prejudiced because it wasn't raised during the preliminary injunction hearing. Under this court's case in William v. Lamb, they addressed this prejudice issue for a late raising of affirmative defense. And it said this court held that if a party was given an opportunity to respond to the defense, then it cannot establish prejudice merely by showing that the case has progressed significantly. That's their argument. Now, this court has jurisdiction over this because it was appealed. We raised it before the court. We appealed that motion. And this court has, because it's an issue of law, you have the right to review it de novo. I'm running into my rebuttal time. If you have any last questions on this issue, otherwise I'll sit down and save my remaining time for the rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Dan Feeney on behalf of the Plaintiff Appellee Russian Media Group. It's important to note that we are before this Court on the narrow appeal of two interlocutory orders. That is the February 19, 2009 preliminary injunction and order and the July 16, 2009 ruling denying an emergency motion to modify that injunction. That motion was denied, as Judge Rovner observed, not on the merits. It was denied for three independent reasons, two procedural, one jurisdictional. None of those independent bases is challenged by the defendants before this court. The emergency judge did not say she could not rule because the preemption issue was before this court. The emergency judge ruled that because the injunction itself had been appealed, they elected to appeal that she concluded she could not modify the injunction as they sought because it risked depriving the appellate court of jurisdiction. That issue has not been challenged. That's the basis for that court's ruling. It's an open question to me how that order can be appealed and reversed without some error found in the three rulings made by the emergency judge. No errors are identified by the defendants. It's also important to understand the exact conduct that gave rise to these claims, to understand exactly what Mr. Harmelick and his entities were doing in these buildings. And it is, as Judge Hamilton described, they were committing piracy and fraud on DirecTV and Dish Network. There's no dispute as to these facts. They obtained retail receivers through pretense under other names, claiming they were for single users. They took these active receivers. They connected them to the wiring of large apartment buildings that had heavy concentrations of Russian tenants. They assembled then a package of pirated Russian channels, and they charged these Russians $25 to $30 a month to access those channels, undercutting the legitimate sales of Russian Media Group and causing substantial losses.
Can I ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Korninsky? Whether or not the illegal actions of the defendants could have been prevented under the terms of the state court settlement?
Your Honor, the state court settlement agreement did not address issues of the defendant's access, of how the defendants were obtaining the signal that they were providing in the building. And I think that's the enforcement proceedings that took place after judgment was entered in 2001, years before this action was brought, the enforcement proceedings had to do, and the settlement agreement had to do with Mr. Harmelick and his company's misuse of my client's equipment. In fact, that was the crux of that 2001 litigation, was the fact that they had come into these buildings. My client bought this business out of bankruptcy.
So why couldn't you have presented to the state court the evidence of the continuing violations and obtained help there?
Because the state court retained jurisdiction to enforce the terms of the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement didn't say one way or another how Mr. Harmelick should obtain his signal. The state court agreement provided that they would not interfere with our equipment, that they would allow us access to the building.
That's what they were doing. They were interfering.
It was a mechanical interference. They were unplugging receivers. They were tampering with equipment.
Why would it matter how they were doing it, as long as they're doing it? That's, you know...
They weren't interfering with our ability to provide our signal. They were undercutting our sales. They weren't physically interfering with our signal, Your Honor. And I'll accept, even if that was a remedy, that would have been a separate proceeding. Res judicata applies if there is a piece of litigation, same parties, arising from the same operative facts, resolved by a final judgment.
Now what you're saying, bottom line, is that the facts were different.
The facts are different. There are different providers. Every act of piracy is a different transaction. I think the analogy about stealing a car in 2001 is not the same as stealing a car in 2008. There would have been different proofs. The authorization they may have had in 2000 differs from the authorization they may have had in 2006. They were pirating from a different provider. They were defrauding DirecTV beginning in 2005. I think this is a separate transaction. On top of that, the Illinois Cable Piracy Act did not give Russian Media Group a private cause of action until 2003. So it would have been impossible for my client to have brought these claims in the 2001 litigation. I think for all those reasons, the res judicata argument fails. I also would like to clarify, and I think it's telling that still before this bench today, the defendants are not owning up to the fact that they were engaged in blatant illegal piracy. And that's telling because that goes to whether the district court abused its discretion in providing the injunctive relief it did. That's a continuation of their practices throughout the lawsuit of dodging, ducking, weaving, trying to come up with different amorphous justifications for what they had done. Mr. Harmelick, on the stand in front of Judge Dara, under oath, gave two completely conflicting stories explaining his operations in these buildings, and neither one was accurate. His opening line was that he doesn't charge for signal. He maintains the wires in the building, and the benevolent customers pay him $20 to $35 a month, independent of any content or signal on that system. The district court properly rejected that as wholly unsupported by the facts and implausible. After that point was rejected, Mr. Harmelick then said, I actually have contracts that authorize me to provide this service. And I have those contracts through my other company, USA Satellite. Now, Mr. Kornitsky said USA Satellite wasn't allowed to intervene until 2009 in this case. USA Satellite was not identified by the defendants in discovery. In fact, Mr. Harmelick, under oath at his deposition, was asked about this company, USA Satellite. He disavowed under oath having any relationship with that company, claimed he didn't know who the shareholders were, didn't know who the officers were. We now know he is the controlling officer and always has been of that company. He is the trustee of the sole shareholder of that company and has always controlled its operations. So for them to that revelation, that second story that Mr. Harmelick told on the stand in front of Judge Dara, I have contracts, this MDU agreement that Mr. Kornitsky refers to today, that authorized me to do this. It's through USA Satellite. So he's just contradicted his prior deposition testimony that USA Satellite's irrelevant in these buildings. And then when Judge Dara rightfully says, show me those contracts, all Mr. Harmelick produces is a partial single contract, this MDU contract that defendants still contain was improperly suppressed and would actually show that he has authorization to do this. That contract is in the appellate record. The contract does nothing of the sort. It specifically authorizes Mr. Harmelik to sell certain American packages, and it authorizes him to sell them as a broker, signing up customers directly with DirecTV in exchange for a commission. It has nothing to do with these buildings. In light of that,
And has nothing to do with Russian language?
Nothing. It specifies. Exhibit A and B of that document, this is at R320, Exhibit A and B detail the channels that are provided under that contract. They're all American channels. There are no Russian channels under that contract. So the district court did bar that document from consideration because it found it was a clear discovery violation for Mr. Harmelik not to have produced it previously. But this claim that that contract authorized his conduct was completely abandoned after seeing the contract itself. Even Mr. Hamelik's trial counsel did not argue in post-hearing briefs that that contract authorized his client to provide Russian channels. That they have resurrected it today, I think, speaks volumes about their candor with this tribunal and Mr. Hamelik's litigation conduct throughout this proceeding. The injunction at issue, their complaint is that others in the marketplace can obtain legal authorization to sell Russian, and Mr. Harmelik cannot. Well, these others in the marketplace haven't been found to have, for years, engaged in illegal piracy in these buildings. The case law is fairly settled that it's well within the discretion of a federal court to fence in an infringer, someone who has violated the statute and shown a propensity to violate the statute, and not even that here, a propensity to be dishonest about that violation with the district court. Those people can be curtailed in a way that the person off the street is not. And the remedy is there. If Mr. Harmelik truly can obtain a legitimate way to provide Russian in these buildings, his remedy is to go to the district court and seek modification of that injunction. He did file that motion. The district court did rule in November that he was denying that motion without, it was not with prejudice, he was denying that motion because the district court concluded, as did the emergency judge, that he lacked jurisdiction to modify an injunction that was before this court. The district court did not find that that specific argument was to be decided by this court, whether the injunction should be modified based on changed facts. The district court simply found, you've elected to appeal my injunction, and now you're asking me to modify its substantive terms. My conclusion is I don't have jurisdiction to do that while that's on appeal. Well, that injunction is up above. That order has not been appealed. That order is not before this court. I could speak briefly on the point of preemption. It's already been covered that the only way preemption is before this court is through the appeal of the July 16th order of the emergency judge. And that judge did not rule on the merits. That judge held, for three reasons, that motion should be denied. Judge Dara had set a scheduling order at the defendant's request, giving them a date certain to file a motion to modify, and this motion was filed outside that scheduling order. The second ruling, the emergency judge found that the motion was not properly brought as an emergency. It was an emergency motion to modify a five-month-old injunction.
Wasn't it filed when Judge Darrow was not available?
Exactly. As the emergency judge said, her language was sprang into action as soon as the assigned judge was out of the office. Denied for that reason. And then also denied on a jurisdictional grounds. They do not challenge any of those rulings on appeal, nor did they seek to correct that by filing that same motion as a non-emergency before the district court. I'm happy to address copyright preemption on the merits. I don't think we need to get there. I will point out one flaw with their argument that the WGN case from 1982 from this court holds that television signals are within the subject matter of copyright. The WGN case actually holds the exact opposite. That wasn't a preemption case to begin with. It was a question involving a rather outdated technology. The WGN used to send with its 9 o'clock news something called teletext, which could be viewed on a separate station, but it was embedded within the same signal, and it was to be viewed back and forth. It was not the modern teletext that runs along the bottom of a screen. It actually took up the entire screen. But the question before the Seventh Circuit in that case was, is the teletext covered by the registered, the copyright on the news program? And the Seventh Circuit held because this teletext was meant to be viewed in connection with the programming, it was covered by the copyright.
But so is that your response to their argument that your claim isn't limited to the signal, but it's inextricably involved in the programming itself?
No.
Because it's concerned only with Russian language programs? Is that your response?
No, that's not my response. If I could conclude the quote from the WGN case. The Seventh Circuit says specifically, it is the text that is protected by the copyright, not the signal. And that the exact quote is, copyright is in the programming rather than in the method by which it is transmitted. That is the holding in WGN, which contradicts their position that the signal itself is part of copyright. Our position is that the right being asserted under the Cable Piracy Act is in the satellite signal. And that signal is a method by which copyrighted content can be communicated, but it is not the copyrighted content itself. It is a format, a platform, on which copyrighted content can be transmitted. The satellite signal, the content sent on a satellite signal isn't necessarily copyrighted or copyrightable. It is separate and distinct from the copyrighted works.
So you're saying that your claim is limited to the signal.
It is. The statute limits us to the signal.
And it doesn't involve the programming.
As in any satellite piracy case, the harms that flow, the damages that are suffered, the motivations of the parties are, of course, impacted by the content that's being carried on a satellite signal. That would be the case in any issue of cable piracy or satellite piracy. But what is protected by the statute is the integrity of the satellite signal. They have breached that in violation of the statute, and through that breach are able to sell at almost no cost a product that competes with my client's product. And my client has to pay for the programming, for the satellite bandwidth, for everything. So that is how my client is harmed, because they're able to put together a competitive product with stolen goods, and what they're stealing is the signal, as prescribed in the Act.
You had claims under other statutes as well?
We did.
Is there also a common law unfair competition theory here?
We have, I believe, our single common law claim is unjust enrichment. We have a statutory unfair competition and a statutory consumer fraud claim.
Okay, and those include additional elements?
Correct.
Beyond what the Copyright Act.
Correct.
But the district court never reached those.
Never. And I would say that the Cable Piracy Act includes additional elements.
That's more debatable. So.
Well, and again, there are multiple avenues under the Cable Piracy Act, which obviously there was no need to explore which avenue would best avoid the gray area of preemption in this case. For example, Mr. Harmelik was found under Section 19 of the Act, which prohibits one from directly using an intercepted signal, and it also prohibits a party from assisting another in using that signal with an intent to defraud. Intent to defraud is not an element of copyright infringement. We cite cases to that effect. In addition, the standing under the Copyright Act is limited to copyright owners, where that's a separate determination than the standing under the Cable Piracy Act, which goes to aggrieved parties. Finally, in addition, to prove a claim under the Cable Piracy Act, you have to show that what's being used, this method of transmission, qualifies as a communication service. It's a very specific, defined type of transmission. That's not an element at all in a copyright case.
I may have missed this. How many years are you in business?
My client began in 2001. They acquired the business out of bankruptcy.
And how many years has Mr. Harmelik been in business?
I can't speak to that. I know that when my client began, after buying these assets, going into these buildings to get them up and running again, found that Mr. Harmelik was in these buildings using the equipment that we had purchased. out of the bankruptcy. So at least in 2000-2001, he was in business. Now, what he was doing at that point, there's no record before us as to exactly what his conduct was then. We began our discovery in this case focusing on 2003 forward. He's represented that he's been engaged in the same kind of piracy using fraudulent single-user accounts going back to, I guess, before 2000, or at least before the lawsuit was filed in 2000, although it's undisputed that he wasn't pirating DirecTV at that time. It's questionable. I'm not certain whether he was pirating Dish Network at that time. I guess I would like to dispel one other myth that presents itself in the pleadings. This preliminary injunction was not some hasty, rushed affair where Mr. Hamelik was deprived of an ability to defend himself. The lawsuit was filed in 2006. There was nearly 2 years of discovery, dispositive motions, including a fully brief motion of summary judgment on res judicata. Then we filed our motion for preliminary injunction in March of 2008, at which point the defendants sought another 60 days of discovery before they even responded to that motion, then filed a substantial written response, then there was a full day of evidence, then another round of substantial post-hearing briefing. So the indications we hear that this injunction should be more narrowly tailored because it was a hasty summary proceeding is really unfounded. And the argument that out there in the world today are contracts that they can enter into to allow them to do this legitimately is an equally dubious claim, given the fact that they had over 2 years to assemble those contracts and present them to the district court, or even modify, abandon their pirating system and adopt this allegedly legal approach, and neglected to do so. In light of that, in light of all that conduct, the district court clearly did not abuse its discretion in crafting this injunctive relief. I think the res judicata discussion is addressed fairly clearly in the briefs. I would add an apology that maybe our brief took the bait a little bit and made the discussion more complex than it needed to be. I think that the discussion is really straightforward. Either their violations, their continued piracy after the final judgment was entered in 2001, constitute a separate transaction. And even if they don't, then they are an ongoing violation, an ongoing illegal conduct, which by the very cases they cite, is not prohibited, is not barred by res judicata. So under either of those two approaches, it's really a rather simple decision to be made.
Oh. Thank you.
You're welcome.
What a gift.
Again, and then in terms of the evidence of the lost business, my client's harm faced with a competitor who was underselling by about 30% with an illegal product, they don't challenge the evidence that the district court expressly relied on. They don't claim it was impermissibly admitted. It more than supports the findings of the district court. There are no further questions. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Feeney. Mr. Krasinski.
Your Honor, I'd like to address the preemption issue first. During Mr. Feeney admitted that television programming, Russian television programming, covered by the Copyright Act. He said that what they're arguing now is that signals are not, satellite signals are not covered by the Copyright Act. The WGN case says that television programming is covered by the Copyright Act. In the complaint, in the briefs, in the district court's preliminary injunction orders, they only talk about Russian television programming. There is not one single reference, and thousands of references, well, hundreds if not thousands of references, to signals. Every reference is about Russian television programming. The first time that they raise the term television signals is in their appellate brief. And that's because they're trying to rely on two district court cases that suggest that signals are not covered by copyright. We admit that. But what happened in those cases is completely different from here. In those cases, DirecTV and Dish Network sued people who were making these bootleg receivers. They'd go to Radio Shack, get the electronic equipment and access cards, put them together so they could intercept signals and decode these the encrypted signals. Then they turn around and resell those receivers to other people. That's not what's happening here. Cable America, USA, they don't buy and resell these receivers. They don't intercept signals. They don't decode these encrypted signals. They take the programming and they give it to the subscribers. That's what happened in WGN.
But how do they do that?
They do that using these receivers that they obtain from DirecTV, that they purchase from DirecTV. Because it's covered... Because it's the allegation is that we have distributed Russian television programming that brings it within the Copyright Act. It's preempted. These allegations are preempted by the Copyright Act.
Are you pirates?
Your Honor, we raised this issue with Judge McGann, okay? Let me say this. Judge Darrow found that we were pirates. Judge McGann did not. RMG did not. In a 2001 case, they said they dismissed this action with prejudice, and they said we could continue doing business. We litigated this on three or four occasions that are listed in our brief before Judge McGann. This never came up there. They didn't like the decisions they were getting in the state court, and they went forum shopping, and they ended up in federal court. Now, we discussed, well, okay.
What about the issue of not presenting the preemption below? In litigation that seems to have taken a significant period of time.
That we didn't present it during the preliminary injunction hearing? Your Honor, Cable America and Harma did not. When USA Satellite, let me back up. USA Satellite was not part of the first litigation. These allegations that USA Satellite withheld their agreements and everything, there were no discovery requests towards USA Satellite.
Well,
when USA Satellite...
Is it correct, though, that Mr. Harmelick was asked about USA Satellite?
Yes, in the 2006 deposition.
And what did he say?
He said that Cable America, that USA Satellite was not offering this Russian programming.
And that he had no connection with the company?
No, that's not what he said, Your Honor.
What did he say?
The question was whether Cable America was presenting these services and whether USA Satellite. This is during the 2006 deposition. He said no, because USA Satellite at the time was not. In 2008, the situation had changed.
What did he say about the ownership and control of USA Satellite?
He said first that USA Satellite owned the assets of Cable America. This can be found in his deposition at page... At page 4, that's in the docket 83-6. Okay? That under further questioning, they asked him what was the legal relationship between Cable America and USA Satellite, and he said he didn't understand the legality of it. He's not a very sophisticated person. Okay? You know that they bought the assets. Okay, but the issue here is not whether the ownership. The issue is whether who is presenting and distributing the Russian programming.
No, The point is, you're trying to distinguish between among the different defendants, and the plaintiffs are saying, well, Harmelick was concealing that from us.
No, he wasn't. In 2006, Mr. Harmelick told about the existence and discussed the existence in his deposition about the two corporations, Cable America and USA Satellite. They say that he concealed it until the 2008 preliminary injunction. That's just false on the facts. If you look at the deposition in 2006, pages 4 through 12, Harmelick discussed Cable America and USA Satellite. He did not conceal the existence.
Was he ever directly asked, are you an owner, officer involved in USA?
Your Honor, he was asked about who owned, what his position was in Cable America and USA Satellite. I'm going from memory now. I know he talked about his positions at the two companies. I don't know what he said. Again, it's on pages 4 through 12. I know he said he was an officer in one of them, but I don't want to say that it was Cable America or one or the both. Because I just don't recall. Okay. Okay, so going back to the preemption issue, under the WGN case, under Mr. Feeney's concession, The Russian television program is covered by the Copyright Act. Signals are not. But this case is about Russian television programming, at least for the last 6 years.
If it was presented below, perhaps we'd have a different injunction before us. The district court had an opportunity to...
Your Honor, that's a fair comment, okay? But we have the opportunity and the right to raise a defense at any time up until trial, as long as they have an opportunity to respond. Okay? We could have raised the preemption defense at trial. There's no obligation to have to do it before, during, or after the preliminary injunction hearing. Discovery was ongoing. It's still ongoing.
But it has to be presented to the district court.
And it was, Your Honor, three times. My time is out, but it's in our answer, our motion to stay, and our motion for to modify the scope of the injunction.
You have a minute.
What?
You have
a minute. Oh, a minute? I'm sorry. Mr. Feeney commented on the preliminary injunction proceedings and said it was well briefed. Our issue there is that the district court abused its discretion when it didn't let us present evidence to rebut the penetration summaries. The penetration summaries were produced the day before, the disconnect notes were produced the day before the hearing, and the summary was produced 3 days before the hearing. We never were allowed to take any discovery about that. We wanted to bring and call a live witness, Ms. Petrov, who is a person who actually completed the disconnect notices. We believe that she would have confirmed our suspicion that this information was falsified.
Who presented the disconnect notices? Who offered that evidence?
Mr. Feeney, RMG offered the penetration summary, which relied upon
no,
the...
Who offered the disconnect notices, the evidence that you say was falsified? Who offered that to the district court?
We offered in evidence because it was the underlying documents for the summary. And under the federal rules, that information has to be introduced into evidence. Okay? My time is up. Thank you.
And thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.